Welcome to Indie Media On Air. First, the headlines. The Palestinian National Information Center reported that the Israeli army killed, since the beginning of the Intifada in September 29, 2000, 4,032 residents and injured 44,666, excluding 8,435 residents who received treatment by the field medical teams. The total number of Palestinian children killed during the Intifada arrived at 750, in addition to 732 residents, including 262 females, who were killed when the army shelled Palestinian homes. Also, Israeli soldiers killed 344 members of the Palestinian security forces and 817 school students and teachers. According to the report, the army killed 325 Palestinians in extrajudicial assassinations. For more on this story, please visit indymedia.org. From indymedia.org, witch hunt in Italy. An intense action initiated by the ROS and DIGOS, a special police force used to repress social and political movements, has been carried out against anarchist collectives in several regions of Italy. As of May 19th, over 50 people have been arrested and face accusations such as being a part of a, quote, subversive organization. The stated reasons for the detentions is Article 270. Social reactions are seen as subversive association, subversive propaganda, and aversion. From the Italian Penal Code, which has frequently been used by the Italian state against every form of dissidence in the last few years. This allows the Italian government to make accusations without any proof, only because they are suspected of being involved in supporting the group that may have committed a crime. People reacted with two big demonstrations held on Saturday, May 21st. The charges are related to a letter bomb sent to Prodi, the European Parliament member in December of 2003, and assigned to the FAI. It is the same charge thought to have been used by the FBI for the seizure of Indie Media servers hosted by Rackspace in October of 2004. For more on this story, please visit indymedia.org. Bilbao Vizcaya Bank attacks Zapatista communities. On May 19th, Vizcaya Bank notified the Enlace Civil organization that their bank accounts would be canceled on June 19th. Enlace Civil activities in support of the Zapatista communities are legal and transparent and have been properly documented and registered with the government departments, which have never given them permission to receive donations without having to pay taxes. This legal status means that Enlace Civil is subjected to rigorous and permanent financial surveillance by the Mexican authorities. When questioned about the imposition made by the BV Bank, the manager refused to give an explanation and only answered that the bank should protect itself from money laundering, and he was doing what he had been told to do. About a month ago, the bank did the same thing with the Maya Health Indigenous Organization of Chiapas State, a civil organization that promotes health in the indigenous communities in Altos de Chiapas. With no reason or explanation, they were told that their bank accounts were going to be shut down. The action of the BV Bank, together with the paramilitaries and the political and economic elite of Mexico, is part of the silent battle against the Zapatista communities. The Enlace Civil organization calls on everyone who is in solidarity with the Zapatista movement to publicly denounce the BV Bank action in Mexico and in the world, to make sure that they know that we refuse to permit them to abet conquest racism, disregard for humanity, and the war of annihilation against the indigenous peoples of Mexico. For more on that story, please visit indymedia.org. And this from indymedia.us, 16 arrested at Mountain Justice Summer. 16 people were arrested and are currently in custody for their participation in a peaceful protest in Sundial, West Virginia. Residents of the Coal River Valley are fighting for the lives of their children, whose elementary school is under attack from the mountaintop removal mining operations of Massey Energy. Coal dust from a coal prep plant only 150 feet from the school enters through air intake vents, causing asthma and other respiratory problems, and coating everything with a toxic black powder. For more information, please visit tennessee.indymedia.org.
Thank you.
All right, we're back. This is Indie Media On Air, and we have a very special show for you today. We are going to be talking with Robert Jensen and Louis Vandenberg. Robert Jensen joined the University of Texas at Austin faculty in 1992 after completing his PhD on media law and ethics in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Minnesota. He teaches graduate and undergraduate courses in media, law, ethics, and politics. Prior to his academic career, he worked as a professional journalist for a decade. In his research, Jensen draws on a variety of critical theories. Much of his work has focused on pornography and the radical feminist critique of sexuality. In more recent work, he has addressed questions of race through a critique of white privilege and institutionalized racism. Jensen is the author of a number of articles and books, among them Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity, and Writing Dissent, Taking Radical Ideas from the Margin to the Mainstream. Welcome, Robert Jensen.
Great to be with you.
And we also have Louis Vandenberg. Louis Vandenberg has twice been the Democratic nominee for United States Congress, running in California's 44th congressional district, which spans Riverside and Orange counties. He lost those races to the incumbent Republican. He is the member of the Democratic State Central Committee and the Central Committee of Riverside and Orange counties. He first volunteered at KPFK, actually, at the age of 14, and currently is the producer of Ian Masters' Background Briefing and Live from the Left Coast programs, heard Sundays at 11 a.m. and 12 noon, which he has produced for the last 2.5 years. Professionally, he is an administrator and department head within the University of California. Among those he cites as influences is the recently deceased Oscar Brown Jr., a poet, performer, and social activist, with whom he had the honor of working within the late 90s and early 2000s. Vandenberg's website is vandenbergforcongress.com. So, welcome, Louis.
Thank you.
The idea for the discussion today is to explore the space between what is often referred to as the left, as distinguished from progressive or liberal. A few weeks ago, I heard Robert Jensen here on KPFK discussing the need to expand the left-liberal dialogue or debate, and Indie Media On Air seemed like a good place to do this. So I'm very pleased to be joined today by both Robert and Louis and discuss this topic in terms of political definitions, political action, cultural issues, class issues, etc. And I think the appropriate place to start is by defining what we mean by the terms left and liberal. So, Robert, I'd like to ask you to start.
Well, they are important terms to clarify, especially since progressive has become kind of a dumping ground term to obscure some of these differences. I take the word liberal to mean someone whose political philosophy is not fundamentally opposed to either capitalism or U.S. domination in the world. So in that sense, John Kerry is a liberal. John Kerry is hardly anti-capitalist, and he's not anti-empire. He has a different vision of what capitalism and empire should look like compared to the Bushites, but it's not a rejection of those two concepts. To me, the left means a principled rejection of any system of domination. To me, that means capitalism, it means state power, it means male domination and patriarchy, it means white supremacy. I take it as a consistent position that says any concentrated power that gives one group of people basically power over another is assumed to be illegitimate unless it can be defended. And I don't think any of the systems I just talked about can be defended at all.
Now, Louis, would you agree with those definitions that Robert's using?
I think that Robert's definition of left is much more refined and elaborate than I would probably offer. My thoughts about liberalism is that for me it's the core essence value of what the United States should be. Coming out of the Enlightenment, it informed the thinking of the founding fathers, and the best traditions of the United States come out of this, what I would call the liberal tradition. And it's interesting for me to see the right wing attacking liberalism in the way that it does, because to me they're attacking the United States itself. When I think about my own political identity, I don't wake up in the morning, look in the mirror, and say, look at that liberal or look at that progressive in the mirror. For me, my concerns are very pragmatic about people who are alive right now and who I want to help and I want to serve and I want to see them be able to have the best life on this planet that we can offer them. And I think the goal of government, the job of government, is to facilitate that, to facilitate the human experience in the best possible way so that we realize our human potential in the most complete manner. And my political activism comes out of that and comes out of a sense of what might be called social justice. And that has pragmatic consequences and pragmatic implications. And for me, I think that we need to do certain things to establish a government that does what I said before, that facilitates the greatest realization of our potential as human beings. And right now, we're seeing a whole panoply of things which are very, very dangerous to that. And so I think, as I look at the history of the United States and the history of human progress in civilization on this planet, there's a generally progressive arc to it of getting away from tribalism, getting away from differences, and realizing our common humanity and working towards maximizing that appreciation. And I see what's happened now under Bush and the Republican regime as sending us backwards. And so I think Bob, who I greatly admire, and I've spoken to a couple of times privately about a number of issues related to this, I tremendously admire what he's saying in terms of theoretical terms, but I believe that we have to act pragmatically and act in the best possible way to deal with the problems that are facing us, that are huge. They're overwhelming problems.
And your pragmatism, for example, involves working within the Democratic Party framework.
That is correct.
And Robert, I heard you make a comment, actually, about not being interested in that framework.
Well, actually, that's not entirely true. I think Lewis and I agree on being pragmatic. When I outline a left agenda, I don't want to imply that it comes with a kind of holier-than-thou position that we have to bring the revolution or nothing else matters. I consider myself very pragmatic and very realistic. I think that the social change that Lewis speaks about, I'm very interested in, and it's a question of how to achieve it. Part of that is about analyzing the system and why the social injustice we see happens, and then the second phase is trying to figure out how to change that. And I think both of these are very important analyses to go forward. So I think naming, for instance, capitalism as the fundamental problem is very important. And that doesn't mean that every time I go out in public and speak, it starts with some, you know, tribute to Marx and the denunciation of capitalism. I try to adjust rhetoric to audiences. But the fundamental analysis on which we base our politics is very important. And here, I think, again, we see the limits of the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party, let's say Bill Clinton, which was an administration often called liberal, was committed to the same free trade policies that keep much of the third world enslaved and impoverished. And I think those have to be rejected. Therefore, we have to form the critique of the economy that allows us to reject those. Now, the Democratic Party is, to me, like any other political vehicle. The question is, can it take us to a better place? I, in fact, had a conversation this morning with a colleague here in Texas about strategies for possibly using a congressional race as a way to raise the visibility of certain issues that we care about. And I would happily run for Congress if I thought that I could, you know, make the argument that it will take the movement forward. But the Democratic Party is a vehicle for serious social change in this country, I think, is at this point an illusion. I don't see that the party can be transformed. I think there's going to have to be another electoral vehicle that emerges. I don't exactly know the specifics about how that will happen, but I do think that's a point that's very important to argue out.
Here's the problem with what you just said, and I would agree with a number of elements of it. I don't see a better vehicle than the Democratic Party. I don't see an option to working within the Democratic Party that's actually viable, that exists in some, I hate to keep using the same word again, but some pragmatic context. And I would also tell you, from being in the party very actively since the mid-late 90s, that the party is who shows up to participate. There are institutional elements to the party, and those are where the problems are. But we can, I think, change those elements by getting active, getting involved, and trying to turn this super tanker around. I don't like to use that image, but it's very difficult to steer this enormous vehicle, but it can be done, and I see that the change is happening. I was just, I think, a month or two ago at the state Democratic Convention in Los Angeles, and there is a visible, a palpable tension, because the rank and file of the Democratic Party is, as whatever term you want to use, liberal or progressive or even left, not to conform with your definition precisely, Bob, but the rank and file is very left, very liberal. It's the leadership of the party where the problems are, because I think anything that becomes an institution such as the Democratic Party, it develops a lot of baggage and a lot of problems with respect to people just to stake out territory, and they won't leave it, and they're very much committed to their methods and connections and so on and how they run things. But there is movement in that party, and I will tell you that Howard Dean taking over the Democratic National Committee is probably the best thing that has happened to that party for 10, 15 years. That is a very significant event, and some of the things that he's doing. For instance, I would say that my political worldview is most closely aligned with Bernie Sanders of Vermont, who is running for Senate. Who did Howard Dean endorse as an official endorsement of the Democratic Party? And that would be Bernie Sanders. Bob, make a lot of excellent points, and you identify capitalism as a problem. The thing is, how are we going to get outside of it? This is something you and I discussed privately, and you touched on in the interview with Ian Masters, and I was sort of yearning for a further explication of it. But it seems to me that, is it capitalism that's the problem, or is it greed, which it functions, I think, in the human psychology, something like a narcotic? People get addicted to greed, and they get addicted to power that comes with wealth and social position and from political position and so on and so forth. We have to think in a holistic manner about where we want to take our country and how we're going to create a government that actually, because I'm not going to disagree, the Democratic Party needs considerable reform. The Republican Party I see as just an absolute disaster. The Democratic Party does need reform, and it needs to be sent in the right direction. We need to think about issues such as you raise, about how can capitalism exist, or can it exist in the context of our democracy in a way which actually works. And with you privately, we discussed regulated capitalism, and you said that's not good. And I'm curious, I hope in this conversation that we can get into that. And I think maybe if it's not good, you'll probably say because of the corrosive effects of greed and so on and so forth. But is there a way structurally that we can deal with those kinds of issues so that we can provide our citizens with a good quality of life, with a living wage, with the kinds of things, with an education, that we can stop disemboweling the public sector, to strengthen the public sector and get to a higher standard of living for our citizens, much more akin to perhaps what they have in Europe? If there's a model of another country, perhaps in Europe, that you think is working correctly, or somewhere in the world, I'd like to know what that is.
Robert.
Well, I think there are a couple of things I would say sort of in framing all of this, which is we have to understand that the struggle we're engaged in is a long-term struggle. The way in which the right wing has pushed the political spectrum in this country, you know, very carefully to the right, especially over the last three or four decades, has put us in an incredible hole, and any I think any sensible look at politics from a left point of view sees that it's a long-term struggle to try and push the other way. I think if we went back to basic New Deal liberalism as the guiding principle of the United States, which would certainly be an improvement over, you know, the right wing, especially the Bush right wing agenda, we still lose. We're in a crisis. We're in a crisis ecologically, we're in a crisis culturally, and we're in a crisis economically. And I don't think that, that going backwards in that sense to reclaim that is going to be either useful or pragmatically possible. That's my own view. Capitalism and democracy are fundamentally incompatible. Capitalism is a wealth-concentrating system, and democracy is, you know, inevitably in conflict with that. I don't think the problem is just that, you know, a few greedy people take capitalism the wrong way. Capitalism is a system that has grown with is only possible through enormous violence. The enrichment of the first world through capitalism was also the story of the enrichment through empire building. It's a system that you know, one can theoretically, you know, construct in an economics department as workable. But in the world we live in, I don't think it's possible. And I think that in addition to thinking about the end of capitalism, we also have to think about some other big things, like the end of the nation state. I don't think that the human species has a future if nation states are the organizing political principle. I think we have to think about an ecological vision in which the way in which first world people live, that is, you and I and everyone probably listening to this, has to dramatically change because it's not sustainable ecologically. Now, all of this is a huge political project that seems unworkable. But, you know, if you put yourself in the middle of feudalism, it would have seemed that overturning feudalism would have been impossible. Every system of concentrated power looks sort of impenetrable when you're in the middle of it. I think this is a time actually to be visionary. And the reason I say that I think this is pragmatic is because I think basic New Deal liberal Democrat politics isn't very exciting. It's not going to offer people the kinds of visions that will excite them and encourage them to become politically active. We've got to organize the people who have dropped out of the system, and I don't think you're going to bring those people back in with the same old vision. I think it has to be a radical vision. And in that sense, I think being radical right now and articulating that radicalness in a very human and down-to-earth kind of form is, in fact, a very pragmatic path. One other thing I'd like to say just real briefly is that one of the things that a lot of the sort of liberal wing of the Democratic Party does is harken back to a kind of a golden age. People talk about taking our country back. There's a constant invocation of the founding fathers. I think this is both, first of all, historically inaccurate and also politically ill-advised. The founding fathers were not a particularly pleasant bunch of people. They were not only slave owners, they were not only people who committed genocide against indigenous people. They also tried to politically neutralize poor whites as well. They were people who wanted to solidify their power. They were Enlightenment gentlemen who had philosophically some very important ideas. But I don't think we should glorify them. I think it undercuts our ability to analyze. It also alienates people who were not part of that original privileged group. I was at the Media Reform Conference in St. Louis, and I remember talking to a black friend. I said, "What do you think when you hear people talk about taking our country back?" Which Howard Dean, for instance, talks about all the time. And he sort of snorted and laughed and said, "I don't know what that means because the country was never mine in the first place." And those are not only kind of intellectual questions, historical questions. They're, again, pragmatic political questions as well.
Okay. I agree with a lot of what you just said. And I hope you didn't see me in the position of saying that I wanted to take the country back to
no,
some sort
no,
of...
No, I was referring to the very, if you listen to Al Gore, if you listen to Bill Moyers, if you listen to Howard Dean, that's the rhetoric they use.
It is. It's true. And it's something of a cliche. And I think when I hear it, what I subjectively get from it is that things as they are now are not very good. In fact, the trajectory is, as I said earlier, disastrous. We had, for most Americans and for the rest of the world, We were better off under Bill Clinton than we are with George Bush, who I would assert is the worst president of all time. In fact, I believe that he should not be considered to be in the category of an American president, but rather a person occupying that position who is acting as an enemy of the American people and the world. So I think that what they mean by that is, let's get back to a time where things at least made a little bit of sense. But you are absolutely right in saying that we, going back to the New Deal, which would certainly be one of those times when things made more sense than they do now, is not an option. It should be an inspiration and but recontextualized for the world as it exists now, and you identify the correct problems, the environment, and so on. And also, when I reference the Founding Fathers, I'm aware of their human faults, frailties, and their in some cases mendacity. However, they thought and wrote and expressed themselves and their ideas in the context of their time in a way which actually created what turned out to be the most progressive government that the world had ever seen. And I think in the context of their time, they are very, very impressive. And if you recontextualize again to the present, I would say that we need to have that kind of visionary thinking, and we need to rethink the whole thing. But we also need to be pragmatic, and that is what I mean by that is to rethink things at a level of ground truth, to set goals to move forward towards. For example, I mean, the short term, strengthen and expand Social Security, revise Medicare, all of that stuff that Bush has completely messed up in his mendacity and in his incompetence, but also look to revise our campaign finance laws. Let's get the big money out. Let's look at Buckley versus Vallejo, which allowed the money in, and revisit that. Get the money out. Look at instant runoff elections. Certify that our elections are actually real and honest. That would be a huge improvement, a short-term improvement that we can make. We can make incremental movements towards those things that we, in our long-term vision, our long-term thinking, are the sites that we should move towards in this country. So I don't say let's go back to the New Deal, and I don't say let's certainly not go back to the slave-owning Founding Fathers, but take the good things from those things that I view as part of the democratic and the liberal tradition of the United States, and make them real, living, and able to evolve and change to meet the demands as we see them. So those are the kinds of things that I'm talking about. I would still like a further explication of how we can have a system of commerce and exchange that stands outside of capitalism, because it seems, you say, it's accumulation of wealth. So what is there, some place on planet Earth where things are working as you think that they should, so we can see that as a model? Because from what I see, capitalism has some, there is a profit motive that people have, and there is the motive that people have to better themselves, and people do exchange money for goods and services, and we do need to grow food and harvest food, and you said that the Democratic Party was boring, or our system of government is boring. Well, it's much more boring to be starving to death. We have to have some kind of system that actually works for people, and I agree that we need to rethink everything and show some vision, but let's move in a direction that can actually work. And I still, with all respect, I'm not understanding what you mean. What kind of system are we going to get that is actually going to replace capitalism? As we see capitalism now, it's a defective, corrupt system. Can it work? I think it's possible. If there's a better way, I'd like to know what it is.
Well, first of all, it's good to remember that human beings with roughly our brain size, have been on the planet about 200,000 years. Most of that history was lived outside of capitalism, and people fed themselves and exchanged goods and created life. So one of the things we have to work against is the kind of naturalizing of capitalism as if it's the only system that can organize an economy. Now, capitalism does do several things very well. It's an incredibly productive system. But that's exactly what we don't need right now. What we're doing, of course, is producing ourselves into ecological suicide.
I agree.
So some of what, you know, people would point to as the strengths of capitalism are actually its greatest downfall, including the conception of human nature that's implicit in capitalism, which is one of, you know, a kind of degraded human who responds only to greed. Now, I think for those of us on the left, we're often caught in a trap here where if we articulate some well-defined view of an economy, we're told we're being utopian and trying to map out the future for people. And if we articulate principles, then we're told we're not, you know, providing enough of a blueprint. So I think what one does is tries to articulate those principles and look at where in human history they've been made real and how can we move from the system we're in to that other kind of world in which we will experiment along the way. Now, I think there's lots of places to look. For instance, you can look at simply cooperatively run businesses, which have to exist in a capitalist framework. But they do exist, and they do succeed, and they are based on a different set of values in which people with a shared value system come together to not simply, you know, self-aggrandize, but to, collaborate and contribute to a collective effort. You can look at moments in the history of the industrial world. The one cited most often is probably during the Spanish Civil War, when certain parts of Spain were actually run by, in some cases, basically anarchist collectives. Well, those were experiments crushed by force, in that case, the combined force of fascism and communism and, to some degree, liberal democracies themselves. So you can see these hints of how people can organize themselves. But I think these are, in a sense, we don't have any options because the system we are in is so intensely destructive that we have to start this other process. Now, the other thing I think is important to learn from history is what doesn't seem very possible in one moment can become very possible in another. I always use the example of the late 50s and early 60s. I was born in 1958, for instance. When I was born into this world, if somebody had come and said, listen, there's going to be radical social change in this culture in the next 10 years, it would have seemed impossible. We were in the grips of, you know, anti-communist hysteria. Culturally, it was very locked down in the United States. Jim Crow segregation seemed unbeatable. Yet within 10 years, this country was literally on fire. Things became possible in a way that couldn't have been predicted. And that's why I think the articulation of a much more radical vision, which puts forward reforms. So, for instance, I agree with Lewis that, you know, defending Social Security is an important issue right now. That's got to be something that those of us on the left take up because it has real-world consequences. It's also a way to start the discussion about why the fundamental system itself cannot work. And I want to make it clear, I think this can be talked about without reverting to some sort of sectarian language from, you know, that sounds like it came from the Central Committee of the Communist Party. For instance, one of the things I do in public is talk about just how dissatisfied people are with life in corporate capitalism. You know, think about it. We have a world in which everybody knows what the initials TGIF stand for. Everybody knows that thank God it's Friday is the mantra for people who work in the system. Why? Because we work in many of us work in an economy in which the work we do is fundamentally not worth doing, and we can't wait to escape it. Well, that's the kind of dissatisfaction that can provide, I think, very fertile ground for a very radical analysis. There was a poll taken by Businessweek before the 2000 election, which showed that 75% of the American people agree with the statement that corporations have too much power in America. That signals some sort of fundamental understanding that it's not just a bad CEO here or there or a greedy, board of directors over there. It's a fundamentally, you know, unworkable system of concentrated power. And that's where I think we have to start building a political project.
Okay, we're going to have to take a break. I want to remind listeners that you're listening to Indie Media On Air, and I'm speaking with Robert Jensen and Lewis Vandenberg. We'll be right back. This is KPFK 90.7 FM. and in Santa Barbara at 98.7 FM and on the internet at kpfk.org. All right, we're back. This is Indie Media On Air, and I am joined by Robert Jensen and Louis Vandenberg, and we are talking about the space between and the politics between and the approaches between liberal and left and what those definitions mean and different critiques of the Democratic Party as well as capitalism. And it's been a really, really interesting discussion. And I think I want to go back to Louis and ask the question of organizational structure. We sort of talked about it, or Robert sort of brought it up earlier. But before I do that, Alan's reminding me to remind listeners to want to call in. That to call in, the number is 818-985-5735 if you want to join this discussion or have a question or comment. In regards to the issue of structure, one example that was brought up in terms of people trying to do something differently in different models, and I think one example is Argentina, where they actually took the factories back and were organizing production and their sort of small economies without hierarchy. And I think a lot of different organizations on the left, liberal versus left, tend to adopt these sort of top-down structures, and a lot of organizations tend to organize outside of that. What is your response to that kind of approach in terms of organizing? I know that it's not the Democratic Party, and I know it's not addressing Social Security, but it's an example of how people might work together in the future.
Well, I've spoken about that situation in Argentina with Naomi Klein and her husband, who have done a documentary on it, and I think what they've done is fantastic, but I would endorse it completely. I think, again, it's a pragmatic approach to that particular problem, that particular context, in which people took action to improve the condition of their lives. And I think that's what we need to do in this country with respect to our context. And our context is extremely important because, well, there's a cliche that when the United States sneezes, the world catches a cold. And it's extremely important that the United States operate in a prudent and thoughtful manner, because it affects so many people. This is why Bush's actions in the Middle East, which are to promote a war there, which is, I mean, it's for KPFK listeners, it's very old, an old road we've walked many, many times, completely unfounded. This is such a disgrace and such a disaster internationally. The consequences of it are so grave. I remember I spoke with an admiral, I think Jack Shanahan, saying that that the 20th century in many ways was the American century, that the world came to respect those. I mean, the United States certainly did a number of bad things in the 20th century, but the world mostly positively regarded the United States, and they came to appreciate the rule of law and the tolerance and the fun and the excitement that America brought to the world with its entertainment and music and movies and so on. And but what has happened now is the 21st century is in many ways, I think, going to become, and it was his prediction as well, and it's coming true, will be the anti-American century. And this can be laid mostly, I think, right at the feet of the Bush regime and the GOP, because all of the problems that Bob has appropriately identified as associated with capitalism have been exacerbated and amplified hugely by the greed and the arrogance. And Ian Masters has said this many times on the show, the ignorance and the arrogance. You have a person that's totally uninformed but extraordinarily decisive and unwilling to admit any contrary evidence or information. in the embodiment of George W. Bush. And if liberals and progressives and the left have common cause, and I would say in the Democratic Party, I can tell you that there is a very diverse aggregation of special interest with a sort of an overarching implied sense of coalescence without it being specific. But what has brought us all together, and George Bush actually has said this in his first campaign, I'm going to be a uniter and not a divider. And what has actually happened is that not what he intended, but we are united more than ever before in this common purpose. And our immediate purpose should be the preservation of our democratic pluralistic society, which I see absolutely threatened by George W. Bush and his regime, and the Republican Party, which has been hijacked. Ambassador Joseph Wilson, again on the Ian Masters show, said that the neocons have no role in the traditions of American politics, not in the Republican Party or the Democratic Party, that they are parasites who have found a willing host in the Republican Party, and they have steered in a direction of absolute disaster to produce this result that would be the anti-American century, the 21st century. And I think you see with the Bush regime, you see the real present threat of a corporate theocratic fascist state with endless wars, defective media, increasing separation of rich and poor, which is terrible for our society, and a decreasing separation of church and state, which is terrible for our society. So we have a president who is making all the wrong moves, and I think it is extremely important that we all do what we can in the most practical way to get these people, these parasites, out of office, because they are a real and present danger to our country, our lives, and the world.
Lewis, I couldn't agree with you more, but you know, I just got done reading Chalmers Johnson's book, Sorrows of Empire, as well as Hegemony or Survival by Chomsky, and you can't help but get the sense that this isn't new, and it's certainly not just with the Bush administration. It goes back to Wilsonian idealism in the Philippines and many of the foreign policy adventures in the last century.
Chris, I agree with you and Chalmers, and I'm saying that we need to take those good elements of our tradition and move forward and evolve with those ideals and those ideas, and discard those things in our past which were obviously defective. We need to learn from history, which is what this president absolutely does not want to do.
I agree. Robert, why don't you go ahead and jump in here?
Well, I think that in some of what Lewis just said, I see some of that golden age thinking. The 20th century was not a century in which the United States brought law to the world. It's a century in which the United States ran amok in the world, ignoring what were often called internationally for law. The millions of bodies stacked up around the world, especially in the last half of the 20th century, that are a direct result of U.S. policy, are not part of the United States bringing fun to the world. It's the United States filling its role as an empire. Let me talk, and I agree with the critique of the Bush administration, but you know, you can look back at U.S. history and see a president who, during a campaign, lied about the supposed American vulnerability to foreign powers, who probably engaged in vote stealing, and who, once in office, pursued reckless foreign policy adventures that set the tone for this kind of imperial endeavor. And that would be John F. Kennedy, who lied about a missile gap in the campaign, who, along with Mayor Daley of Chicago, is said to have stolen an election, and who immediately pursued in Central America and Southeast Asia incredibly reckless and destructive foreign policy. In other words, the Bush administration is a problem, but I don't think we should see them as the problem. And that's where we have to step back and fashion alternatives that I think are honest about our own history. Are there parts of the U.S. experience that are valuable and should be, sort of highlighted? Yes, the United States has done fairly well in recent years, for instance, in the realm of protecting freedom of expression, which happens to be my field. But even there, we have to ask, where did that protection of freedom of expression come from? You know, it didn't come from elites. It came from the civil rights movement, the labor movement, dissident movements, who demanded that the United States live up to its ideals. And so I think it's, in fact, the radical movements in American history that have made progressive social change possible. And I think that's an important realization if we're going to formulate a rhetoric and a program that can appeal to what are essentially now the disenfranchised, the people who have abandoned the system. I'm much more worried, for instance, about the people who didn't vote in the last election than I'm worried about the people who did.
I agree mostly with what you just said, although I think my characterization of the United States in the 20th century was more nuanced than you represented it as.
I would like to interrupt here real quick and take a call and have some callers join the discussion, if you don't mind, and see if they have a question or comment. And Juan in North Hollywood, welcome to Indie Media On Air. Do you have a comment or question?
Yes, hi, I have a comment. Thank you for the discussion. I think it's really, really important and necessary. I think it's too early to say that socialism hasn't worked. We have to remember that capitalism, to get where it is, it has taken a few centuries. And even with the deformities that took place in the Soviet Union and in China today, there is no way that you can say that the Russian people and the Chinese haven't made any advances. There is no way that you can say that the Cuban people haven't made any advances. Why isn't the left and the most progressive thinking in the United States looking at what Latin America is doing? Are we reading what the Latin American left is saying about the post-Marxism, the criticism that they are doing about that? Look what Latin America is going through right now. Look at Venezuela. What's going on in Bolivia right now? Nationalization of oil and gas. Capitalism cannot be reformed. And what we need is people with a Latin imagination to convince working people in the United States, the 130 million people that have such a decisive role in the history of the world, that there has to be an independent way, not with the Democrats, not with the Republicans, but based on our interests as a class. Mm-hmm. And then we can connect with the immigrants that are coming into the United States. Then we can connect with all of the people in the rest of the world. I think, unfortunately, one of the main problems with Americans is that they are very ignorant about their own history, and they have absolutely no notion of class. They think with working class is something to be ashamed of, when it's contrary, the opposite. We are the ones who are producing absolutely everything. We are the ones who are thinking. We are the ones who are making with our hands all the wealth. And what is proven, like in Venezuela right now, what they are doing with all of the missions, they are proving one more time that we don't need, as a class, as a working class, we don't need any administrator to come and tell us how to manage the factories and how to produce.
One, I want to...
Anyways, I really thank you, I think it was Bob, for your comments, because they were really, really right on. And, you know, forget about the Democrats and the Republicans. They are dead.
Okay, Juan, thank you very much for your call. Bob, and then Lewis, why don't you address that?
Well, I agree with much of what the caller said. I think Latin America is a place where the most interesting political developments are happening. I think Chavez in Venezuela, for instance, is very important, both for what he's doing and how U.S. policymakers reacted. And we should remember that one of the things that John Kerry did in the last election was try to kind of out-hawk George Bush on Venezuela, condemning Chavez. And I think that tells us a lot about where the Democratic Party is. Having said that, I want to make clear that, like Lewis, I think that there are times and places when local Democratic Party organizations might be useful. I was, for instance, talking to a county chairman in Minnesota who happened to be you know, running a local Democratic Party that was very progressive with leftists in it. And I think in those settings, if it's a useful organizing vehicle, that's fine. I think the structure of elections in this country and the nature of the connection between corporate power and both parties means that in a serious way over the long term, the Democratic Party is not going to be that vehicle. I think that organized labor is going to have to break with the Democratic Party. And I think that, you know, the non-white communities are going to have to be at the core of a new electoral formation. I can't tell anybody what that's going to look like specifically, but I can at this point be fairly confident in my assessment that the Democratic Party is not going to be that vehicle. Now, other people will disagree and should go forward with, you know, other plans as they have them, and there's nothing to stop people from working together who have similar goals. But I do think this is an important time to have this discussion and not kind of ignore the differences. The one thing I also would like to say is, you know, when the left and the liberals kind of agree to make common cause, unfortunately what usually happens is the least common denominator politics tends to prevail. The people who already have access to the most resources, which is the liberal sort of wing, tends to prevail. And I think at some point it's important for the left to say, no, we're going to go our own way in certain kinds of organizing endeavors.
I want to say we only have a few 4 minutes left in the show, probably 3 minutes now. And, Lewis, why don't you go ahead and respond to that? And we want to try and get in one more call if possible.
Well, I thought Juan had some very insightful observations. I'm watching Latin America very carefully, and I think there are some of the most important political developments that are taking place there. So I agree with much of what Juan said, and I'd love to have a dialogue with him. He's a very thoughtful person, and I would disagree. I'm going to try to make the Democratic Party work, and when it doesn't work, I'll rethink it at that point.
Okay, we're going to go to one more call. Bob in Gardena, welcome to Indy Media on Air. A quick question or comment?
Quickly, I want to respond. Democrats don't seem to be working. They're not even protecting their own interests. They've done nothing about the privatized electronic system that stole the last election. The Republican-owned machines, and secondly, how can there be any viable third party when there isn't proportional representation?
Thank you, Lewis. And then Bob.
I agree that the Democratic. I mean, it's not difficult to get me to criticize elements of the Democratic Party. I mean, when John Kerry says, "If I knew then what I know now, I'd still vote for the Iraq War," that is profoundly stupid. And then he caves on Ohio, which I totally believe was stolen, as Florida was. I mean, I agree. And the Democratic Party. I mean, it's easy to say, what are they good for if they won't fight for these fundamental things? So that's the question that I'm asking in the Democratic Party, and I'm going to try to get them to stand up and fight.
Okay, Bob, final thoughts.
Well, I think the discussion has shown that there is a lot of common ground and that there can be pragmatic arguments that go forward that don't necessarily split a left-liberal alliance, but point to the different directions each part of the movement wants to head. And because I think in a sort of ironic way, because we're so far in the hole right now, because right-wing forces have been so effective over the last, you know, few decades, I think this is precisely the time to have this kind of discussion and start formulating a more radical vision. And again, I want to emphasize a radical vision that can be articulated in very plain language and that can appeal to ordinary people, not some elitist language that comes out of some rarefied ivory tower.
I want to thank both of you for joining me today on Indy Media On Air. My guest, Robert Jensen, and Lewis Vandenberg, thank you very much for being here today.
Thanks, Chris. Run for Congress, Bob.
And we'll be back next week. KPFK is in the middle of its fund drive. I want to thank D'Angelo Jones, the engineer, and Alan Minsky, the producer.
You've been listening to Indy Media On Air on Revolutionary Radio KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and heard throughout the world at kpfk.org. The Voices from the Frontline edition of the 4 o'clock report is coming up next. Stay tuned.